Ahoy, friends. Thank you for tuning in to Truth and Justice. You are listening to the July 21st Friday follow-up for Season 13, where we talked about Joshua Amos. Today, I'm joined by Bob and Janet. We've got a lot of listener questions, so let's get into it.
Welcome, everybody, and I want to welcome everybody that's in the YouTube chat, talking with us live, and I know Janet has a lot of questions from listeners. Before we get into some of that stuff, I just want to take a little time up front, as this is all still new to us, and just to kind of talk a little bit about process. I know people have a ton of questions about that, and we're learning as we go. So I think I had mentioned last week, if not, it's a good time to talk about it now. The idea of like constantly doing breaking cases as like kind of the requirement for the episodes is much trickier than I thought it would be. I'm learning a ton as we're doing this. So feel free, and you guys are sending tons of, like, we're getting tons of submissions. A big part of what you guys are doing as far as helping out and contributing too is that you are finding cases that you're hearing about and then submitting them. The form is up on the website and you're submitting them through the website. Erica Cantor, who has been a part of our team for a long time, she was production manager on True Crime Binge, is now assisting with me going through some of those and helping me contact people. But they don't need to be breaking right now. As you heard with Josh's case, you know, he went missing back in March, but it's still there are still people actively searching for him. There was in that particular case, there was an active call to action, something that would needed to be done right now. That's why I got bumped right up to the front of the line to make sure that we got that episode out before Tuesday, which is the day we're recording this today. But they don't have to be breaking right now, because it's tough to do, because there's a lot of you guys, you listeners, have really made me aware of things that I need to be paying closer attention to. Like, you know, do we want to do a breaking case of someone who really is maybe trying to flee an abusive relationship and they don't want to be found? So there's a little more vetting that needs to go into those cases. So we're just going to keep going on with active cases from, as we said, every state in the country. I actually have two more already in the can right now that are already recorded, that I'm excited to get out to you guys. And those are, there's not an urgency to either one of them, but they are both still active cases that people are actively still, they're recent and people are still looking for these people. And then we'll still, if something comes up, right? A good example last week, or just a few days ago when we're recording this, most of you, I'm certain, because I don't know, 1,000 of you submitted the case of Carly Russell from Alabama. She was the case where she had pulled over. There was a toddler wandering around on the highway, and she had called the police and told them about it and had gotten out to help take care of the kid. And then had called her family, and then one of her family members was on the phone and heard her scream, and then she disappeared. And the police get there 3 minutes later, and she's gone. It was a shocking case. It was a breaking case happening right now. And so I was kind of scrambling with that one, trying to figure out if I should put something up. In that case, it had tons of attention, right? So everybody knew about it. Becky, my wife, who doesn't follow any true crime, showed me her feed was full of it. It was on the national news. I saw it on our local news in Michigan. They were talking about it. So that there wasn't a real need for me to put the information out, but I decided, okay, well, I'll give this on Monday. If they're still looking for her, I'll do a quick episode. Not going to interview anybody. I'm just going to get on to get the word out. Thankfully, in that case, she showed up. I don't think we have any details on it yet, but she did show up back at home. All we know is that she showed up. She was disoriented. They said they thought she was kind of in shock, but she was okay, and they took her to the hospital. But I'm like learning things about how this process worked because of that.
So I'm going to interrupt for just a second. We had a question come up in the chat that I think is relevant to what you're talking about. And that's Lilius asked if, you know, she wrote into the theories email. Is that where you want these things to go?
You can do that, and I will get them. But now when you go to the website, there's literally a button there that says submit a missing persons case. And that is a better way to do it, because that sends, there's like four specific questions you can type into there, hit it. And those submissions go to both me and Erica. Whereas if you just send an email, it will only come to me. And Erica's doing a lot of the legwork on that stuff. So you can send an email, but you're better off going to the website and just click the submit a missing persons case. It's a good question. But getting back to what I was talking about, then one thing that Erica and I have found by a ton of submissions that come in and searching missing person databases for states across the country is that a large percentage of the reported missing persons cases are teenage runaways, like a massive percentage, at least from what we're seeing. I would say 19 out of 20 cases that are submitted to us are a teenager that had left on their own.
Mm-hmm.
Runaway cases, which is a very complex situation, which is, you know, I'm trying to figure out how to navigate that. I actually spoke with today through messaging, but we're actually going to get on a phone call with Nina Instead, who's a podcaster that podcasts about missing persons cases here in Michigan, and has been doing this for a long time. And I'm so sorry, Nina. The name of her podcast is escaping me. If somebody types it in the chat, or Janet, if you know it.
I don't, but I can try to look it up.
Yeah, if you could real quick. It's a big podcaster. I'm sure somebody will pop it in the chat. And I know it. For some reason, it just popped out of my head. But I was talking to her about that. And I was like, I'm just, you know, she had reached out to me and just said, hey, anything I can do to help? And I'm like, man, I could really use some help. Just kind of knowing ethically.
Already Gone.
Already Gone. Yeah. That's what I thought. Yeah. I know that. Yep. The Already Gone podcast. Great podcast. Check it out. And I'm not just like saying that. Somehow that slipped my mind. But I'm like, I don't know if I should, you know, if they're fleeing an abusive situation or this and that. And she had told, and at least our messaging, and again, we're going to get on a call and talk about it further. She had said that, you know, it's still worth covering those because she works with like a lot of organizations that deal with missing people. She said in most cases, that person is in a lot of danger. Like they end up in far more dangerous situations than they would be if they said you're better off to help them be found, which was good. It kind of, because I've talked to a few people that have sent those cases in, and they're like, please help us, let us come on. And I'm like, I don't know if I should, because I don't know why this person left. But so in any case, I'm very thankful for Nina helping me understand some of that stuff better. And we may be covering some of those cases, but also I may be, you know, as the intro has that stat at the beginning of it and the voiceover, a few people have been like, you know, those numbers are kind of misleading. And I'm finding now as I'm doing more research, because if you look up the statistics, those are the statistics, you know, like 600,000 people are reported missing, or children are reported missing, but also that number is not tied. There's a lot of nuance to it. So I may be changing that intro, because after like learning more and more. And this is a little bit of how the sausage is made, but that's kind of what we do. Try to be very open and transparent with you guys. I'm just uncomfortable with that being kind of how we start the show. So that may be changing anyway.
Okay.
But in any case, just want to let you guys know that, keep submitting those cases. That is a huge help to us. And don't shy away from a case where maybe someone had run away. You know, we'll vet those and look through them. And also another thing I'm thinking, and I haven't done this yet, the ones that I have recorded already are interviews, and there are plenty of families out there that are desperately asking for help. But at the same time, somebody had asked last week, like, do you have to have a family willing to do an interview to do the case? And I'm thinking that, and I don't know what that circumstance would be, but I was thinking about that through this weekend. I think when that Carly Russell case came up, I thought, you know, this not, they need more eyes looking for her, but I don't need to be in this moment right now where this family is desperately looking, asking them to come on a podcast and interview.
Right.
So there may be instances where I may just talk about the details of the case, maybe touch base with the family or whoever and say, are you okay with me covering this? And then just talk about them without an interview. So still very dynamic. We're still figuring this thing out. Just wanted to let you guys know where we're at.
But I also like the idea of you focusing on things that everyone doesn't already know about. I mean, you mentioned that earlier,
yeah.
But you know.
Because, yeah, and that's a huge part of it for me is to shine a light on cases where that people haven't heard of. It, you know, like Josh's case we just talked about in this. Like most people, if you weren't from that area, didn't know anything about it, and it's a tragic case, and they need help. And with that, I guess we should get into that so we can move right into the question.
I mean, I think that the question probably foremost in everyone's mind, knowing that we are recording this on Tuesday, July 18th, Do you have information on how the search went since it was today?
Yes, we had some listeners go to the search. We had a lot, unfortunately, because it was a weekday. It was 8 a.m. on a Tuesday. I had a ton of people that messaged and said, I want to go, but I can't get off work. But we did have some listeners go. And one listener in particular, Ed, thank you, Ed. I don't know where he's from, but he said he's from a few hours away, but he has a motorhome. And he actually contacted the raceway where they were meeting this morning for the search and asked if he could park there overnight. And he drove down yesterday, Monday, sound like a couple of hours, with his RV and stayed the night in the parking lot there at the raceway so that he could help with the search
today.
That's
awesome.
Yeah, it's so cool. And that he was there to help. But he said that they had 132 searchers there.
That's great.
Some of those being our audience members. And they did the search and it just didn't turn up anything. As you heard Christina say, they had dogs that were going out first in the morning. So obviously they didn't turn anything up. And in the search, Ed said at one point someone found bones. And so they thought they had found something. And it turned out they were animal bones. And when they concluded the search, nothing had been found.
Mm-hmm. That must be a devastating feeling to be on a search and come across, even being that they were just animal, just the idea that you came across. I mean, do you know you're out looking for something and to stumble across that?
It reminds me a lot. I kind of had like almost a flashback when Ed messaged me to when I was a fireman and we would go into a house where you thought maybe someone was home and you would, fires aren't like you see on TV. You can't see anything. It's pitch black. Like there's black smoke. You can't see your hand in front of your face. You're relying on feeling to get through a house. It's a weird feeling where when you're searching a house for a victim inside and you're feeling around, there's like part of you, your job is to try to find a person that's in there to get them out. But at the same time, every single time you reach your hand out, you're just praying that you don't find a person on the other end of that.
Sure.
It's kind of that same sentiment of what you're talking about when you're on a search. Like you desperately want to find them, but at the same time, you're terrified that you're going to find something. And so, a huge shout out to everyone, our audience and not. I know that Christina and Josh's family have been sharing our show with as many people as will listen to it. And a lot of those people were there at the search. So just a huge shout out to all of you guys who went through that because it's not as easy. It's not just walking around. There's a lot of emotions and things to unpack when you're going through something like that. And along those lines, a few people had messaged me and they're like, well, I don't know what we're doing here. This sounds just like there are people who think that the circumstances of this case sound like, well, it's just going to be a recovery. They think by now, if he hasn't been found, that he may be deceased. And I just want to explain it because that may be the case in a lot of the cases that we cover. And that may be true. Like there may be a very good possibility that Josh hasn't made it. And you heard Christina kind of touch on that. But what you have to understand is for these families, like that's better than where the world they're living in right now when they just don't know what happened to their loved ones. So if our efforts can help them, even if it's to find in any of these cases, to find the body of their loved ones and they are deceased, I hate to say closure because I don't even know that that's a thing.
Yeah.
But it's
an answer, some kind of answer, even if you don't know why.
It's not living in the limbo of not knowing if you should start the grieving process or if you should still be hanging on to hope. So that's a really big part of this. So, I don't think at all that anybody should be shying away from any case or think that we're not helping because the person may be deceased. Because those families are still just desperately searching for answers.
Kim W. says, for this new format, are we just trying to find the people or find the missing person, or are we also thinking about what could have happened to them?
I think both. Again, that's another thing that we're kind of learning. But, on our Facebook page, on the fan page, there were a lot of people with a lot of good questions. There was a lot of people that were like providing information. Like I see Susan is in the chat here and she's one that was in Facebook who she's familiar with the area. And so she was providing context to the, like one thing that I don't think it didn't come up in the episode, but and that's why we do these follow ups still too, is to be able to provide more context and information. I kind of assume because, I've been to East St. Louis and I know that I'm like, well, everybody knows, but not everybody knows. East St. Louis is a pretty dangerous place. I'm sure, I don't mean it like if you live there, I'm sure there are good parts of it, but there are also part like I believe there were statistics where it's like one of the most dangerous places in America some year recently. Hmm. There's a lot of violent crime that happens there. So it was a very dangerous place where statistically where Josh was kind of wandering around, and Susan was one of the people that's kind of pointed that out because she knows the area a little bit.
Tara says, and this is kind of more of a logistical how are we tracking stuff question, but Tara says, I see a case docs file is up on the website for the new season. Just wondering if more information will be posted there as the season continues. Looking for details on what areas have already been searched and leads that have been followed up on. Is this information readily available? Perhaps this isn't released to the public if it's an ongoing police investigation.
Yeah. So what I put like for Josh's case, so if you, the way I'm going to organize it is if you go to season 13 in the case docs, there's a folder for Illinois. And then if you open the Illinois folder, there's a folder for Josh Amos. And that may be the only case from Illinois, but I did it that way so that if we end up covering another case that's from Illinois, that we can put it there and it's easy to find stuff. But I shared all the stuff that Christina shared with me to put out there. As we get, if there's more information that we get, I will also put it out up there. The case that we're going to be covering on this Sunday, that one has a little bit more. There are some maps and there are some police reports and things like that because it's a much more complex case than Josh's. So you know, we'll put out what we have available to us and that may be helpful. But kind of going back to the original question, so some of the things, the conversations that are happening are just providing more context. People saying, yes, I can go help, or is there another way I might be able to help? There was a ton of people that said, you know, hey, I can't go to the search, but I live in that area, so I'm sharing this on all my personal social media. Like, that's a huge help. But then there are other people that are like, we're kind of like having conversations, talking about what may have happened. And I think that's okay too, within our private group, to have those conversations. And maybe it sparks, you know, that's kind of what we've always done is kind of work together. And that's another area where someone who maybe doesn't live geographically close can still participate in those conversations. And maybe something comes out of that, maybe an idea of a new place to search or a new way to search, like something just I thought of. So most of you guys probably know, like I'm kind of an outdoorsman. Summertime is fishing time for me. And I have some electronics on my boat. Like they're not just the old school fish finders, but like Zach seen them when we got out fishing. And I was thinking, in one of the cases that we have coming up, they use like underwater drones to try to find someone. But that's relying, I believe, on like cameras. And if the water's murky, it's very difficult to see. I know from being a rescue diver in my previous life, it's really hard to see in murky water. But there are electronics where maybe if you're just a fisherman, if you have something called side imaging or Mega Live or Mega 360, something, these are like even in murky water where you could take a fishing boat in an area and graph out, almost draw a picture of what the bottom looks like to help. So maybe not in this case, but in other cases, that's something that may be useful. So just be thinking, but those are the examples of just conversations that could happen, trying to think outside the box, putting new eyes, ears, and minds on these cases. I think, you know, hopefully we'll make some breaks and help to find people if we have new ideas.
Well, I think in this case you could still do it. I have concerns about him ending up in the river.
Yeah,
the river's not far. I mean, that's not the ending we would want to this, but I have concerns that he ended up in that river, and something like that, a fisherman with side imaging. I mean, if we could find something or go look at least.
Yeah, and there in Brian in the chat just asked, is there a lake or river? But yeah, there's a river there. Susan had pointed out where he was at particularly wasn't really close or adjacent to the river, but we don't know how far he walked. We don't know because, you know, there is definitely a big river right there. My brain's telling me that's the Mississippi River, but
it is.
Is it?
Yeah. Okay. Whew.
I almost sounded real dumb there for a second, but there's, you know, there's a big river there. So yeah, I mean, that may be something where, you know, maybe somebody might think, well, you know, I don't have anything to help drag or search a river, but there's technology out there on boats, like little fishing boats like mine, that I think could be really helpful.
Just to put a little more context in, Susan in the chat says, because of the convergence of the rail yards and highways, the area is difficult to travel on foot. It's only moderately populated, sparse residential, mostly industrial, up where he was last seen.
Thank you. That's good because I've been looking at maps for the last couple of days trying to understand where he was at, but not knowing the area, that's very difficult to get a grasp on.
Thank you, Susan. Teresa says, is there a photo of him with longer hair and or facial hair? It's possible his appearance might differ.
No, that's actually something after we got off the air when I was talking to Christina, she said they were trying to find someone that could do like age progression, because she thought the same thing, that, you know, if he's alive and he's out there somewhere, you know, it's been 4 months. So his beard would be longer, his hair would be longer. And that, so that's something that they were looking into doing, but they haven't found anybody that was able to do it yet.
Is there, well, we'll get to that. I'm going to read Nick's now. Will you be joining any of the searches for the season? It seems like East St. Louis would have been a great opportunity to report on site since it's also Midwest. Haven't you sometimes done on-site videos to help listeners understand the geo context in past seasons?
Yeah, I actually struggled with this one a little bit because, so East St. Louis is not close to me, but it's about a 5.5 hour drive. And I actually was trying to make some arrangements to see if I could go down and participate in the search. And unfortunately, it wouldn't, because I would have had to gone last night. And it's tying in with my wife and daughter traveling for a volleyball tournament and my 12-year-old son's home with me this week. And it just didn't work out for me. But like, had this search been going on next week, I probably would have went, yes.
Lauren says, have you considered reaching out to law enforcement? I'm sure the typical response would be that they cannot comment on ongoing investigations, but perhaps they might surprise you.
Yeah, I actually did reach out to law. One of the cases, I haven't figured out if we're going to be able to cover it yet, and it may be one where I might just do the episode without an interview. That's the one I mentioned where I had talked to the, what's the name of it? Missing in Black? Black and Missing. I think Black and Missing. I spoke with them. I was having a hard time getting hold of any family members. I spoke with them. I'm still waiting to hear back from them to, about doing an interview. I called the police department and actually spoke with one of the detectives. It was very nice. Talked to him for just a couple of minutes. But he said, I can't really do an interview without – you have to go through the PR department. So I sent an email off to them, and I'm waiting to hear back from them. So, yeah, absolutely. If there's law enforcement that's willing to talk, then certainly I'm willing to have them on.
On the flip side of that, Teresa says, is there a reward being offered for any information? Perhaps local folks might be more inclined. Someone commented, there isn't a strong relationship among the community and police. I think there is a reward. I think I found something on Twitter when I was looking to see like how.
Oh, that's right. I did see that because I retweeted your tweet. Reward.
Yeah.
Yeah. Look on Janet's Twitter or mine or the show's, because when Janet found that, I just remember that you're right.
There is a $10,000 reward.
There we
okay.
go.
Yeah.
Okay. Lauren says, do you know if anyone searched the Missouri side of the river, like downtown St. Louis, North City, or South City, right when the cross the river into Missouri, the highway splits into four different flyers? I'm so sorry. There are a few typos in here that I didn't notice when I was copying and pasting in here. The St. Louis, Missouri police, could they have flyers? With a soccer team and Cardinals, are a lot of people downtown on home game nights. Might be beneficial to hand out flyers at home games. Don't know if this is allowed.
I don't know if there's been any search on the other side of the river in St. Louis, but that's something I will talk to Christina about. I don't want to reach out to her today because the search and everything was going on today, but in a couple of days, I'll message her. If they haven't tried that, that's a good idea, and I'll mention that maybe go over to that side of the river and pass out flyers over there.
And Susan P. also mentioned the idea of handing out flyers or talking to people who take the train from the station around there. And on a Sunday morning, maybe there would be people who noticed something.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I'd read that one. And she said that it was a good point that, you know, there may be people that regularly take mm-hmm. that train around that time every Sunday morning. So maybe if we go to the train station around 7 a.m. on a Sunday and pass out flyers to those people, that might be helpful. So that's another thing that I'll pass along.
Elizabeth said, Marsha Baker asked about using drones. Do drones with IR or whatever sees body heat exist?
They do. There are thermal imaging drones out there. I don't know how useful that would be in this. I think they have searched with some drones. I'm mixing up because I've covered a couple cases.
She did say that they search with drones.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, I couldn't remember because I've talked to three different people this week.
But weren't sure what kind of drone. I think the question is, what kind of drones were they?
But she's asking about like the thermal imaging drones, which those are useful. I've seen them used if someone is like, say, in the woods. I've actually seen law enforcement use it when somebody's like fleeing from them in the woods, where, you know, they can go over and they can pick up the heat signature of the body moving through the woods. I don't know how, because this is an urban area, so there's going to be heat signatures all over the place, as opposed to like if you're in a huge wooded area where, you know, it's the way they work, it's just like the thermal imaging cameras we use at the fire department, is, you know, the screen looks basically black, and anything that's hot, the hotter something is, the whiter it is. So if you go over like the woods, it would just look like a huge black, and then there'd be a white blip that's moving through the woods and you can find it. But in this case, it's, you know, there's tons of heat signatures that are going to be in an urban area. And if it is, in fact, a recovery effort, it wouldn't help at all because there would be no heat signature.
Okay. I want to get into behavior a little bit. And I also want to commend those of you who are asking questions that could be vital to information about how this could have happened or what the circumstances might have been, but also trying to be respectful of the situation and the families. And that's a little bit of a tight wire, you know, walking on this one. But the first question I'll ask from Kim W. is, was it normal for him to be out so late? Just wondering if that was normal behavior for him or if that was something that deviates from his normal patterns.
I think there was a lot new going on in his life. From, like, as you know, talking to Christina both on the podcast and off the podcast, you know, he was recently separated from, I don't remember if it was his wife or just the, I think it was his wife. I think they were married and they had split up. But the mother of his children, and then he had moved and he got a new job and he had new friends. So like he had only been at that job for 3 weeks. So, and he was hanging out with people from that work. I didn't get the impression that it sounded like when he was, you know, when him and his ex were still together, he was a family man. He was home. You'd go to work. He'd come home. He's home with the wife and kids. I can tell you for me, like when I got divorced when I was 30 years old, you know, all of a sudden it's a weird thing because now half the time you have your kid, but then the other half of the time you're by yourself. And it's like it's a new time in your life to be like, well, what do I do with my time now? I'm used to my, you know, evenings are wife and kids at the dinner table and helping with homework and you know, doing all these things. And then all of a sudden it's like, well, now half the time I'm by myself. And so you find ways to fill the time. So I don't know that I didn't get the impression it was a normal thing, but it may be normal for him, for his new normal, I guess. And I don't know that for sure. But what I know is like everything in his life was new for the 3 weeks leading up to this. So whether he was hanging out with this group and they were going out drinking every Saturday night till 5 a.m, I don't know. I also had some people that were from the area who said like, that part of East St. Louis, like to be out until the early hours of the morning like that is like, I don't remember how they put it, but essentially was like, yeah, if you were going to go out late at the bars and, you know, it's till morning time, like that's where you would go in Washington Park, which is east of East St. Louis, that area is known for that type of thing.
It makes me wonder if there was any other substances used too in that night to be up partying that long.
That's certainly a question a lot of people had as well. Recreational drug use, if there was any open air drug markets in the area.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know the answer to those questions.
Annie says, how and why did he get separated from his companions? Was he acting in any way odd when they saw him last?
It sounded to me like it was just because, you know, everything got chaotic and it was an abrupt ending. So remember, there was a fight in the club and it sounded like there's a fight going on in the club and they pretty much cleared the club and kicked everybody out and called the police. So if you take, you know, say there's 100 patrons in there and all of a sudden they, you know, they're throwing everybody out into the street. I don't think it was like a conscious decision to leave to get away from his friends. The way I understood it in the way from the way the videos were described to me, it was, you know, they all just kind of got shoved out and they got separated and he ended up outside. He wasn't by the friends. And it sounds like he was disoriented. You know, he could have been drunk. We don't know if there was any drugs involved, but he was certainly tired and had been drinking and just was lost. Just wanted, he was outside, didn't know where his friends were, and he was just trying to find a way home and just started walking. I don't get the impression that it was a conscious decision to leave the friends.
Okay. Well, Nancy, just to follow up on that, said, do we have any explanation on why he didn't have his phone, how it was at the friend's house, and why he didn't have a coat?
No, I don't know. I mean, I could see the no coat thing just because, you know, I've certainly done that in my younger years if I was going out with
him. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. I have, it's kind of a funny story with a friend of mine from the fire department who we ended up stuck in the middle of nowhere in a road that wasn't a road up in northern Michigan in a snowstorm with nothing but t-shirts on, because we were going to, on a fishing trip, we decided to take the evening and go to the bar, and we thought, we don't want to lug around these big coats and take them inside and
sure.
mess with them. So we went in just t-shirts, and which it turned out to be a terrible idea. The phone, I don't know. And it all comes down to kind of behavior. Was that normal for him to just leave his phone and not deal with it? The fact that he was going to a dance club like that could be, you know, shoot, nowadays everybody has, some location services and Life 360 and different people who can tell what maybe didn't want anybody to know where his, you know, like my ex, we've been divorced for over it. I've been married to Becky for a decade, but we are on the same Life 360 account because we both track our kid. And if anybody that uses that app, you know, if you're on it, you can see each other. So it's such a weird mix of the kids, Becky and I, and my ex and her husband are all on the same. We can all see where everybody's at. You know, so it could have been something like that where we're like, well, I don't want anybody to know I'm going to the strip club, so I'm just going to leave my phone here. Maybe he just generally doesn't carry his phone with him. I don't know. But I want to point out that there's nothing about these are all great questions, but there's nothing about this case to me that indicates that he was like trying to get away from, you know what I mean? So like the leaving the phone there, it's not like, well, he left it there so that he could escape and nobody could track him. You know, remember with the bus driver, the one person he had contact with after he left the club was the bus driver who said he was just trying to get home to Granite City. He was trying to find his way home. He wasn't trying to get away. He was trying to get home.
So doing some like reading on it, and this is possibly way off in left field, I don't know, but doing some reading, there's a few articles that mention that he's possibly bipolar. Do we know if he is bipolar? I mean, it didn't seem like the mother mentioned that, but there's some multiple articles that kind of bring up that he's bipolar.
I've seen one, and there, I think Janet has that question that somebody had a listener posted that too, because in the article, I believe it says that his family was quoted as saying that he was bipolar. And that maybe he had some drug problems in the past. I don't know the answer to that. When I saw that question and saw the articles was today, and I was going to reach out to Christina to ask those questions. But again, today was the day of the search.
Right.
And so it was like I wasn't going to contact her today to ask. So if I find out that information, I'll ask about it. But again, it kind of comes – a lot of this is very important information. It's good to know. But again, it very much seems like the circumstances in this case were that he was tired, at least drunk and disoriented, and also cold. Like, I mean, it doesn't take very long, and I think it was actually 23 degrees at that time in the morning that day. It doesn't take that long in those temperatures to become hypothermic, and that starts to affect your cognitive ability. So you have all of those things working against him. But the one thing that he was broadcasting to the bus driver again was that he wanted to go home. He's right. Trying to get to Granite. And she knew home was Granite City. You know, so we know that conversation happened, that he wanted to get home to Granite City.
That's all I have from the Facebook posts.
Okay. Well, unless either of you guys have anything else, or if there's anybody in the chat that has a burning question, I think we can go ahead and wrap this thing up for now.
Totally off topic. I brought it up last week, but we finally have a date. My episode of the JV Club came out yesterday. So Thursday.
Yeah. Yep. So when this airs Friday, when you're hearing this, yesterday, Zach is on Janet's other podcast, the JV Club.
That's right. And he answers some burning questions like me saying, hey, how do you get good at being tattooing? If you being a tattoo artist, if you start out bad, who are you tattooing? That was a very
It was an enjoyable conversation without... Renter over here.
Without me interrupting. I do want, on a serious note, I do want to touch base about this Sunday's episode. I'll tell you this. I was in tears a few times today editing the episode.
Damn it. I'm going to be a mess.
Yeah,
it's a rough one. But I was editing the conversation that I had a few days ago with this individual. Incredibly interesting, incredibly heartbreaking case. and this person is still missing, and I don't want to give too much away about it until Sunday, but it's an area that we're all very familiar with and an agency that we're all very familiar with, and it is a tragic, well, listen on Sunday. We'll talk about it more in the follow-up, but definitely listen to it. It's a very interesting interview, and it'll be a little different format because the person I was interviewing, I literally said, tell me about your loved one, and she started talking, and which will be shocking. This will be shocking to a lot of you. She spoke for over an hour without me saying a single word. So, and goes through the whole case. But so in this one at the beginning, I'm going to break down the case first, so you guys know what she's talking about with some of the stuff that she has on there. So anyway, make sure you tune into that on Sunday. And with that, I think we can end this week's Friday follow-up. Thanks, guys and listeners. We love you all.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, guys.
Justice is an NBI Studios production. All music for the show is created and composed by Shane Yoder at PutThemInASong.com. The font you see on all of our logos and banners were created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Katie Ross of CreatedInTandem.com designed, created, manages, and maintains our website, Truth and Justice Pod, where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Pamela Westby, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Erica Cantor, Melissa Cardenas, Kaywood Yomnick, and Danielle Rohr. And as always, thank you to all of you for your engagement and your support. If you like the show and you want to support us, you can do that in a number of ways. The number one way for you to support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. If you join our Patreon, not only will you be financially supporting our work, but you'll also get something for your pledge. For just $5 per month, you'll get all episodes ad-free and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups that include an hour-long pre-show chat exclusive to our patrons. Other levels will get you a Truth and Justice Army t-shirt, Truth and Justice hats, and even the opportunity to co-host a Friday follow-up episode. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny, and it goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a case that you'd like us to consider covering, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. And the most important thing that you can do is engage in our investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page, follow us on Instagram, or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. For all of you tweeters out there, you can connect with us on Twitter at Truth Justice Pod. To follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth, Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.